from Oklahoma State. He'll be talking to us today about greenhouse gas emissions from bioenergy cropping systems in the southern Great Plains.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everyone. As the title says, I'll be presenting something about the greenhouse gas emission measurements that we made in our bioenergy cropping systems in the southern Great Plains. And I'd like to thank my co-authors on this, Kundan Dakal, he's in the crowd here. He's a graduate student. And then Pradeep Wagle and Ansett Foster, they're my former graduate students. Pradeep is now at USDA ARS Grazing Lands, and Foster is at, he's with Kansas State University. And the other co-author is Tracy Wilson. She's now at Oregon State, and Jason Warren, our soil environmental specialist. And, okay. So coming, I've taken a different approach here. I'll be presenting the situation we are in, the tasks, and then what action we took to achieve those tasks, and then finally results and some conclusions. In terms of the situation that's prompting us to more towards biofuels, probably it would be tough to say now we want to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels with the gas prices being so low. So one of the things is that the climate change impact, or the mitigation of the climate change impact through biofuels. So the recent IPCC, the 2014 projections, they say that the climate change is going to have a significant impact on crop yields. So, and it's going to be more negative impacts. And for this, we need to limit the carbon in the atmosphere to about 450 or 500 ppm so that the temperature or the warming can be limited to less than 2 degrees centigrade. And for this, IPCC identifies that the carbon capture and sequestration is one of the important options for limiting the fossil fuel emissions. And in that, the bioenergy has a critical role for mitigation. But again, we have to consider the sustainability issues. So that's where the greenhouse gas emissions come into picture. And also, there is robust evidence with some medium confidence that these bioenergy systems can help us in achieving those the sustainability. And the next one is, again, to maintain the temperature below 2 degrees centigrade. A tripling or quadrupling of the share from zero and low carbon energy supply is required. And again, in this, the bioenergy, along with carbon capture and sequestration, by the year 2050 would play a significant role in terms of limiting the impacts of climate change and also help in mitigation. But there are some issues that we need to consider. For example, we need to identify the bioenergy options with low life cycle emissions, and some are already available. Switchgrass has been shown to be very highly energy efficient in terms of the total life cycle, and also those that can reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, and also the biomass to bioenergy systems, they should be more efficiently integrated into the current land use, making it more sustainable. And also the direct options in agriculture, forest, and other land use involved in reducing CO2 emissions would be very critical, and also in terms of providing the bioenergy feedstocks. And another approach we have taken is it's not just enough if we study a single crop at a single site, but the other thing is the current agronomic research and crop models. As we know, these crop models are mostly point-based simulations, and they're either plot scale or point-based, so we need to expand that to give a sustainability assessment of these bioenergy feedstocks, because there is significant spatial variability in terms of the climate and environmental factors, especially the soil, land use, and land cover. And also, plot and field estimates, they do not necessarily translate well at regional scale. So we need to identify solutions to scale up these studies. So the task that we had was huge, and these are a series of tasks that we incorporated in here to understand the sustainability and also the greenhouse gas emission scenarios. But mostly today I would like to concentrate on this in terms of estimating the carbon sequestration and climate change mitigation potential of bioenergy crops. But all the other above tasks directly feed into this, in terms of identifying the best management practices and also enhancing the diversity, productivity, and resiliency of the bioenergy crop species, and also some of the others in terms of number six here, modeling the spatial variability of biomass, yield, and soil properties in switchgrass fields under different growing conditions. So these are a whole range of tasks that we addressed as part of our study here. And also, as I mentioned, we wanted to scale these greenhouse gas emissions. So our ground truthing here was through the eddy flux systems. So we wanted to develop empirical algorithms for net ecosystem response in response to the environmental factors. And we created an environmental database for Oklahoma using the weather network in Oklahoma. That's called as MesoNet. And then we scaled this up to parallelizing this entire process on our HPC for frequent updates using both our the MesoNet and also the environmental data sets that we were getting from the eddy flux systems. And to achieve this, as I show in the Oklahoma map here, we had about six locations around the state that were looking at the bioenergy crop production per se. So we had sites all the way from the northwest in the panhandle that's pretty dry with less than 15 inches of rainfall. And in some of the years when we had these experiments in the years 2011 and 12, we had close to less than 6 inches of rainfall at those sites. And as we move towards east, the Lane station receives almost about 45 to 50 inches of annual rainfall. That gives us a gradient in rainfall, and also from north to south, there's a range in or a gradient in temperature. So that gives us quite a variable environment to study the production. At the same time, use the data sets produced here to develop algorithms that can feed into our both empirical and mechanistic models. And at the same time, we studied different cropping systems there, either monocrop or mixed crops of switchgrass and energy sorghum. These were both monocrops. And then we had a mixed grass plots that included native species, switchgrass, Indian grass, and big bluestem. And for ground truthing, as I mentioned earlier, the eddy flux towers were used to measure both carbon and water fluxes. And we used vented chambers to measure the nitrous fluxes from the experiments that we had at multiple locations. One of the things here is the eddy flux studies were done at a single location, that's at Chickasha in Oklahoma. And then the vented chamber studies, they were done at Stillwater in Oklahoma. Our eddy flux system was a complete flux system that included for carbon measurements, also wind speed, quantum and power sensors, soil heat flux, air temperature, soil moisture, and temperature. So we measured what we could that are needed for in terms of meeting the energy balance needs of the system or in balancing the energy of the entire system. But still, we had some missing data sets because we were not accounting for the energy used in photosynthesis and other stuff that's related to energy capture by the plant. And from the vented chambers, the measurements were done at frequent intervals. Immediately after fertilization, the measurements were made on a daily interval for the first week, and then on we had weekly measurements of nitrous fluxes from these. And the gases were analyzed using a GC in the lab. And in terms of, because the eddy flux system, they usually have missing data or large gaps sometimes, either because of weather or some instrument failures that we cannot attend to them immediately. One of the neat things we did was we have a data streaming facility where the data is streamed to the lab and we can check it on a 5-minute interval or an hourly basis that pops up errors. And we were at the times, most of the times, getting back to the station in the next 2 to 3 days and correcting the errors in the instrument. So whenever we had some larger gaps due to weather affecting the measurements, the NEE was filled using a relationship between the Net Echo System Exchange and PPFD. We found that the PPFD instead of the solar radiation is a good indicator of the NEE. And then also the water fluxes were also filled using the PPFD response to water flux. And then finally the soil temperature was used to fill the gaps in ecosystem respiration. So all these were done dynamically using an Excel spreadsheet. So that was the most of the action that we did in terms of collecting the data and then smoothing out any errors and filling the missing gaps. In terms of our results, this is a look at the total bioenergy crop production over 4 years, 2010 to 2013. You can see these three different species here, mixed grass, sorghum, and switchgrass at different sites. And obviously, sorghum stands out at most of the sites in terms of its productivity. At the same time, mixed grasses and switchgrass were slow in the establishment year, about 1 to 2 dry tons. But as we move on to 2013, I'm not presenting here the latest data that we collected for 2014, but we are still in the process of harvesting the 2015 too. So it's been a long-term study here. Probably it would continue for the next couple of years. The mixed grass and switchgrass initially low, but they're reaching about 10 to 12 dry tons per acre at multiple sites. And we see an improvement in this production in the 2014 and 2015 years. They're getting up to 18 to 20 dry tons, depending on the year. And also in years where we had significant deficient rainfall, say for example 2011 and 2012, the sorghum crop failed at several sites. But whereas the grasses, the perennial grasses like mixed grass composition or switchgrass, continue to improve in their productivity. So that's one good thing in terms when you're looking at having a sustainable crop production scenarios. And other one of the, even though the talk is on greenhouse gases, but we cannot live without water for bioenergy production. All these cropping systems that we did were under rain-fed conditions. So one of the important things we need to look at here is the difference in ET of these crops, how the water is used differently by these crops. For example, switchgrass greens up early by March, and then its peak water use is around May, June, and then it tapers off. Whereas sorghum, being a warm season, it's planted in the month of May, and then its peak water use is in the months of June and July, and then it tapers off. So when we are planning for these cropping systems, so there is a distribution in terms of water use, and the water available in the system can be used more efficiently by choosing the right crops for the location, depending upon the rainfall patterns. And also these two crops were found to be significantly water use efficient at the ecosystem level. So compared to some of the other native grasslands or other currently used croplands for energy production. So both switchgrass and biomass sorghum have a ecosystem water use efficiency of close to 12 to 14. My slides in here. Okay. In terms of the net ecosystem exchange, as we can see here, both these crops, switchgrass and sorghum, they continue to sequester carbon all through the year. And these are the cumulative curves for the net ecosystem exchange as we go through the season. Switchgrass seems to sequester more carbon when compared to sorghum. But you might be wondering, in the previous slides, we have seen that sorghum is producing more biomass, so we assume that it should be sequestering more carbon. But one of the things we found in our studies is that switchgrass sequesters about 50% of the biomass into the roots, whereas sorghum puts in only about 20 to 25% into the root system. So there's a significant difference when you're trying to decide and using these species for, say, especially for carbon capture and sequestration. So even though the above-ground biomass harvested from switchgrass is less, the total benefit of the switchgrass system is much larger in terms of the carbon sequestration potential. And we saw the same trends both in 2012 and 2013, and we are continuing to see similar trends in both 2014 and 2015. The data I have not presented here. And why this becomes important is, as we try to adapt these systems as we move forward in terms of pulling more carbon from the atmosphere. And the other factor that's been affecting the carbon sequestration in our studies is the impact of drought in the stressed years like 2012. We can see that sorghum is plateauing out much earlier than that of the switchgrass net ecosystem exchange. So this is mainly due to the impact of drought on sorghum compared to that on switchgrass. Switchgrass appears to be more tolerant to drought, and it's also able to sequester carbon under those extreme high VPD conditions in Oklahoma. So we have seen that, or we have shown in some of our publications that switchgrass, the VPD response drops down after around 3.0, but whereas in sorghum, at a VPD of 2.2 to 2.3, the stomate starts closing, and then you see a decrease in the carbon capture by the sorghum system. So obviously that reflects here in the cumulative net ecosystem exchange. But whereas in a good year in 2013, we have almost both of them following similar trends, but obviously switchgrass being a little higher in terms of its carbon sequestration through net ecosystem exchange. And in terms of the flux measurements for nitrous, we did in four different nitrogen rates for all the three species. I'm just showing an example here for switchgrass. So these are the mean flux by days since treatment and nitrogen rate. So here we have the days since treatment and then four different nitrogen rates. And these peaks are those that were developed immediately after fertilizing the crop. And from there on, you might have small peaks here and there that are mostly a reflection of the rain events during the crop growing season. On the whole, as we go through the cropping season, a week after fertilization, most of it is a continuous stream of flux emissions without any major high fluxes from the soil environment. And we observed similar patterns in switchgrass, sorghum, and the mixed grass species. No significant difference in the species in terms of their canopy cover or due to the impact of any other factors that are going to affect your microbial activity. When we summed up all of this together into estimating the cumulative N2O emissions across different nitrogen rates, we came up with an average rate of about 0.75% of the total amount of nitrogen that was applied. So these are the rates across different years for 11 to 12, 12 to 13, and 13 to 14. And the average cumulative N2O losses for the 3 years were about 0.75%. And we found that this nitrous losses in the arid climates are much lower than what IPCC is using right now. That's close to about 1.25%. So There is a need to probably revise the IPCC estimates for the semi-arid or dryland regions in terms of how much of flux emissions we are using when we are trying to look at the mitigation potential of bioenergy crops. So that can have a significant impact on how much mitigation we can achieve when we are using these bioenergy crops. So these are especially under rain-fed and extremely dry and hot climatic conditions. So we need to put that into picture when we are trying to simulate these crops in the southern Great Plains especially. So we cannot use the same flux emissions that we have in the Midwest for producing these crops that are with high rainfall and moderate temperatures. As I said, it's one thing to measure, but when we want to make some large-scale or regional decisions, one of the things that we did here was, this might be a little bit confusing graph, but it shows the plan that we took in terms of deriving the spatial scale simulations. So we used our eddy flux measurements, and then we have shown that these data is of good quality. And then, as I mentioned, we did gap filling to fill some of the gaps that came up as part of the environmental disturbances. And then we developed some functional algorithms in terms of the ecosystem respiration, net ecosystem exchange in response to your PPFD, the photosynthetic photon flux density, and to also to the vapor pressure deficit. So we developed a SAS-based algorithms initially, and then Kundan, our PhD student, he has developed a Python program that could automate everything and then simulate on a regional scale. And then these algorithms were then fed into the system, and then the data was assessed for quality both from MesoNet and also from the algorithms that we developed. And then when we compare the observed and the predicted, the net ecosystem exchange, or for here, in terms of the amount of carbon we are sequestering, we had an R-square of about 0.92. So we found that this empirical approach that we are taking here works pretty well in terms if you have a good data set of your environmental variables. So then we selected the potential switchgrass areas across Oklahoma, and this included areas based on the cropland data layer from NAS. And then we selected fallow or idle cropland, the pasture, grasses, shrubland, and also the herbaceous grassland types that have a potential to establish switchgrass on there. And all these areas were simulated for using the empirical equations that we developed earlier. And what we come up with are these maps for the total carbon sequestration potential across Oklahoma. So the blue areas are the regions with high carbon sequestration potential up to 40 to 43 tons of carbon dioxide per hectare. And the red ones are regions where there is minimal. So in dry years such as 2011 and 2013, we see a significant decrease in the total amount of carbon that we can capture. But whereas in good years, where we have good amount of rainfall, say for example in 2014, we could show that we have a significant potential for carbon sequestration. So we are trying to scale this up to include climate change impacts on top of this to see what sort of scenarios we can determine for future years where we see a significant increase in temperatures and also a decrease in rainfall for the southern Great Plains. So this gives us a very good setup in terms of doing the future scenarios for climate change impacts. And we cannot just leave it there, so we compared our seasonal cumulative NE that from each of those five sites that I've shown in my task graph where we did all the biomass evaluation studies. And then we compared the biomass production there with that of the net ecosystem exchange that we modeled at each of those sites. So what we see is a very tight correlation between the switchgrass biomass that's produced and the net ecosystem exchange. So almost an R square above 9 at all the sites. And also one of the things I want to bring to your attention here is the slope of the curves is different. Obviously, you would expect a 1:1 slope. The only difference here is because of the biomass production potential of those sites. For example, at Lane, you have about 54% of the biomass or the carbon captured is going into biomass. But whereas Woodward, only about 8 to 10% of the biomass carbon that's captured is being put into the total biomass. So that's a reflection of the environmental system in there in terms of higher respiration rates for the system in Woodward compared to the system in the Lane because of temperatures and also the rainfall that's being received at those particular sites. So this sets a good stage for us in terms of determining the amount of carbon sequestration potential. So in conclusion, both switchgrass and sorghum are strong sinks of carbon dioxide, but the difference was mainly due to the difference in their length of growing season and also the ability of switchgrass to sequester more into the soil. And we need to have more data that needs to be included into IPCC projections from semi-arid regions so that we can have a more accurate information on the nitrous fluxes or N2O losses. And probably we have demonstrated the potential impact that it could be used for regional and global level understanding of carbon sequestration. And if you have any questions, or if you have time.
Yeah, maybe one quick question.
Yeah.
One of the last revision slides, that the biomass for switchgrass showed highest in 2012, and yet that 2012 was one of the largest units.
For
switchgrass.
Yeah, that's what I said, because even though it's dry, it's the type of the rainfall pattern at those sites. Oklahoma receives a bimodal rainfall. So you have dry months of July and August, but you have rainfall in April, May, and then you have rainfall in September, October. So switchgrass is very resilient to rainfall compared to sorghum. Sorghum would die under those conditions. In 2012, we lost sorghum. But switchgrass would survive and then green up again when you have the rain events. So the later month rainfall events help switchgrass to grow again, come out of the drought, and then put a lot more biomass.